as presenting graphic images of the state and their depictions of anthropoidal beings chained and controlled by Babylonians whose faces resemble those of whites. He contends that the fall of man resulted from the interbreeding that occurred through the pure-blooded Aryan and the anthropoid beast men, and that all contemporary non-whites are hybridized products of this miscegenation, and that the white race lost much of its higher faculties through such mixture. Other sources have considered these anthropoids to have been the remnants of Lemuria, who migrated into the area of the Earth occupied by the Aryan race at later times prior to the sinking of the continent of Lemuria, its remnants now submerged under the ice of Antarctica. Von Liebernfels stated in this work that only through transmuting and controlling the base drives and through eugenical upbreeding could Aryan mankind continue to exist and to regain its first estate, that which existed in antediluvial times. He claimed that the divine spark was exclusive to the white race and existed only in them. Radiation of certain kinds, he contended, would elevate the consciousness of the Aryan, transforming them into Superman, they being endowed with a higher consciousness and more capable of manifesting the divine will through their acts. Jörg Lanz von Liebernfels was a proponent of astrology and incorporated it in a work which is not publicly available as far as the author is aware, entitled Practical Theoretical Handbook of Ariosophic Astrology. He apparently was affiliated with Werner von Bülow, who was also an astrologer. Von Liebernfels' work is largely untranslated into contemporary language script, being only available in the Fraktur script, which was banned in the Third Reich by Martin Bormann. Von Liebernfels was ordered to cease to write during the Third Reich, perhaps owing to the divergence from the National Socialist Weltanschauung, though this writer cannot say for sure. The Arminists began to come out publicly through Guido von List, who put forth his conceptions in the comprehensive guidebooks, The Secret of the Runes and The Rite of the Aryo-Germanic Folk. The former work went through the history of the Arminian Futhorc with its 18 runes, which many modernists have claimed to be invention, though this is not the case, it being more ancient than either the Elder or Younger Futhorc and a source of rune workings utilized by the Arminists, the Aryan adepts who are the torchbearers of the primordial Aryan tradition. Von List's work revealed the presence of the runes in heraldry and their meaning and use, their being symbolic of metaphysical concepts and employed in magical workings. In his work The Rite of the Aryo-Germanic Folk, he discusses the Rite, which means the law of the Nordico-Germanic race, and how it was oppressed and all but destroyed by Christianity. This latter work reveals the most ancient law of the most ancient race of human on earth and the true poverty of Abrahamic religion, which, as von Liebernfels would agree as regards modern Christianity, is a pale shadow of its antecedent. Other Arminists came out with similar expositions of the tradition, from runic yoga and its poses and sequences to other magical exercises. However, no one source publicly available known to the writer provides an adequately detailed description of Arminist practice such that one could undergo a self-initiation, and represents the Aryan tradition as an adept. Presumably only they who have undergone initiation in an actual order are permitted to possess the secret of the runes in practical fashion to be able to qualify as an Arminist. A subsequent pseudo-Arminist, the disciple of Stephen Flowers, Alfred Avery, has compiled a work that purports to serve as instructions on Arminism. However, the work is in the writer's opinion yet more pagan reenactment in the manner of Stephen McNallan's Masonic Asatru, a neo-pagan reconstruction that has only a pretended historical relationship to the Aryan race and which purports to be universal, inclusive of any and every non-white in its midst. Avery also puts forth, like Flowers, a Zoroastrianism attempting to revive the dualistic religion from ancient Aryan Persia, which served as a prototype of Christianity and was possibly created by Jewry. This is yet more distortion, false association and pagan reenactment that the wise will take with a grain of salt or avoid entirely in their quest for Promethean fire. The Arminists in the proper sense, who existed before and contemporaneous with the rise of Hitler, could be spoken of as the only legitimate group that is known to the writer to have existed, though he is certain that they exist clandestinely at this present time, only not having released any detailed works that can be drawn upon and that are not contaminated with extraneous material that borders on the cartoonish or childish, such as most contemporary neo-pagans. Adolf Hitler critiqued the Arminists in Mein Kampf, contemptuously referring to them as venerable old greybeards lacking adequate practical sense. In doing so, he demonstrated his more worldly orientation and his focus upon mundane affairs and, though right in recognizing the necessity of practical action, was wrong in his apparently dismissive treatment of they who constituted the spiritual leadership of the Aryan race and indeed of the sum total of so-called humanity who depend upon the orderly world of the Aryan to enable them to achieve a sustainable and harmonious life. Rudolf John Gorsleben was one of the foremost representatives of Arminism and wrote the work The Zenith of Humanity, which served as a compendium of Arminist practice of greater amplification than the works of von Liszt. Gorsleben advocated a eugenical practice which incorporated an upbreeding of non-whites through the white man having multiple wives and intercourse with non-white females but not vice versa, owing to telogeny and microchimerism and of course the non-utility in eugenics terms of white females playing the two-backed beast with non-white males, which, as with von Liebenfels, he considered a recipe for downbreeding. The white man thus is the source from which springs the divine spark, and with his destruction the light of the world is extinguished. The Arminist practices of Gorsleben entail an amplified meaning of the runes and their usage, as well as runic yoga. Other than this, magical practices are largely omitted, and thus his work is deficient in providing a comprehensive guide for anyone seeking truth and immortality through this means. Miguel Serrano would later go beyond these teachings in his incorporation of Tantric Methuna, but overall the Arminist works prescribe a philosophy more than they do a practice which suffices as a base upon which to build, but in and of themselves they are inadequate. Further Gothic ripples can be observed in the works of Karl Maria Weiligott, a high-ranking SS officer whose works were compiled and translated by the disinformation agent Stephen Flowers in The Secret King. Flowers put forth a biased analysis of the history of Weiligott, though his translations are the only available in English and thus are the best that can be obtained. Weiligott's works divulge some historical details of Arminism and its occult philosophy, referencing the deity of Centaur Crodo, the god Saturn who had become captive by the ice rings now encircling him, hearkening to the Golden Age prior to this event when Saturn was a central sun of our solar system. Siegfried Adolf Kummer also had written a work called Holy Rune Might, which is now no longer available in print as far as the writer is aware, and therefore is not able to divulge any particulars, having never seen it. The Arminist tradition continues forth to this day in undercurrents not readily discoverable by the mundane, though certain publishers continue to publish the few works available in English. There exist German works written in the old Fraktur script which have not been translated and reveal more explicitly magical practices, such as the use of pendulums by Friedrich Bernhard Marby and others. Pichu, an affiliate of Aleister Crowley, also had released some works which were more of a syncretism of Egyptian Masonic works and hence not entirely consistent with the Arminist practice or Weltanschauung. That Stephen Flowers had translated a couple of Schuh's works, especially those referencing Christianity and Christ, should indicate the suspicious nature of Pichu and his works. As with later German occultists, their works are quasi-Masonic syncretism and do not entirely reflect the original Arminism of von Liszt and Gorsleben. Indeed, they are a suspicious lot, as they dovetail with the left-hand path in its more Masonic form, such as the Ordo Fraternitas Saturni of Gregor H. Gregorius reveals with its Saturnian way of realization. However, there is truth in this as well, and, though often stigmatized by Christians and other religious bigots as satanic, it is actually Saturnian in the sense of attempting to provide the reader with a way out of the time cube of the Moon-Saturn matrix that the religious are endeavoring to perpetuate as a means of perpetuating their slave system. The path to follow in this dawning age of Aquarius is that of the leftward swastika, the left-hand path of God-making. To develop one's consciousness in accordance with the higher ideal of becoming a living God through the magnum opus is the goal, and the Arminists, though in of themselves inadequate, are an essential element in transcending the limitations imposed upon the consciousness of all by the system of religious mind control that keeps all trapped within the cube of the demiurge. Radical traditionalism. What has been called radical traditionalism by some of its proponents and original formulators is an ideology or philosophy oriented around an attempt at following an authentic spiritual path, one which can properly be spoken of as a tradition in the sense of Julius Evola and to a lesser extent René Guénon. These two figures will be the focus of this section as they are the foremost representatives with the most comprehensive and extensive works of radical traditionalism the writer is acquainted with. A caveat for the reader is to not fall victim to the pseudo-radical traditionalism of such as trad Catholics and other Abrahamic religious bigots, as they are not an authentic tradition and hence cannot be radical. The Abrahamics in recent years have sought to distort the writings of the radical traditionalists to suit their agenda of influencing naive people to become conscripted into their ranks through the right versus left false dialectic they orchestrate as the hidden hand behind the scenes. Thereby they are seeking to neutralize legitimate opposition to their despotism. Both Julius Evola and René Guénon have significant divergences in their approach as to what they consider tradition and their investigations and philosophical analyses in light of their initiate background serve to inform the reader from an authoritative stance on many abstruse and confused points regarding various spiritual traditions that have been mistaken by moderns for authentic spiritual paths. Both figures differentiate between what they refer to as tradition, of which there is only one, the primordial tradition or original form of spirituality and modernity, that which has existed subsequent to the fall of man and the mixing of races and castes over the last 5 millennia within what has been called the historical period. Tradition thus represents what came before modernity within the time frame of the Kali Yuga, so called in the Vedic tradition, also referred to as the Iron Age in Hesiod and the Edda respectively. Allusions by Hesiod and later Plato, as well as in the Vedic texts, to Hyperborea, the land beyond the borders in the Arctic, the far north, reference the homeland of the primordial race of the Aryans and their tradition. Neither Guénon nor Evola spoke of Lemuria or Mu, the more ancient continent which existed and later sank and which was a homeland to a comparatively primitive Neanderthal stock who adhered to a more earthly mother goddess cultus and its rites of savagery, and which stock later became to varying degrees amalgamated in the Aryan race through mixture over the subsequent millennia. For René Guénon, a Frenchman who was born Catholic and became a Freemason, tradition was something present in all living traditions and was thus accessible, save with the exception of Christianity, in the currently existent mainstream religions, Hinduism, Taoism, Islam, Judaism, and little else. All else he deemed syncretic inventions of modernity. He was a disciple of Advaita Vedanta, a strain of Vaishnavism, and became a Muslim later owing to, according to him, not being a member of an Indian caste and thus not being able to participate therein according to the mainstream religious restrictions. His stance has been critiqued in the article Counter Tradition in the work Aryan Imperium by the writer, as well as a section on monotheism herein. To synopsize, given that the current mainstream religions are exoteric syncretisms and serve as de facto mind control programs, no properly so-called authentic tradition can be found therein, as they are a tangled mass of dogma, and thus no truth can be found exclusive to any of them, and none of them are entirely true but mired in falsehood and occult blinds and literalist dogma. Guénon's work is valuable in its exposition of various religious traditions and their inner esoteric meaning, which is unknown to the profane or mundane and which assists in pulling the scales from the eyes of the purblind masses. The reign of quantity and the signs of the times, as well as its earlier and more limited antecedent, the crisis of the modern world, are an analysis of the present time as viewed from the Vedic perspective of temporal cyclicity, and are a diagnosis of the Kali Yuga or modern age and its inherent chaos. Guénon's solution is to bury oneself in mainstream religion and attempt to find the truth within the shell of exotericism, and thereby shield oneself against the storm and stress of the Gotterdammerung. His solution is of course false, as a rigid regulation and rule-based exotericism of mainstream religion simply imposes artificial human-invented structures upon the person, which the clergy pretend to be derived from God as a means of legitimating their power in the eyes of their minions, the profane laity. Julius Evola's solution fares better in his work Ride the Tiger, which provides a guide or compass for the warrior priest of the Kali Yuga. This and the conclusion of the path of cinnabar prescribe certain forms of action that enable one to attain a transcendent consciousness and to ride the tiger of modernity, i.e., the Kali Yuga, to become a berserker warrior in the age of the Fenrir Wolf. His left-hand path approaches his self-analysis and intellectual autobiography describes, was adhered to throughout his life and followed by him to the end. Spanning all of his written works and activity, his aim was always the summit of the mountain top following the solar Uranian path of the Kshatriya warrior priest, the left-hand path Vomamaj, of imminent transcendence. His works reveal this clearly, and the path of cinnabar is a single source which synopsizes all of his written works and artistic activity. The writer would prescribe the above works of Avolo as well as the following, which he will critique in briefest outline to give the reader a basic understanding of their value, meaning and utility. The work Revolt Against the Modern World provides a basic overview of the history of the world from Atlantis onward and the reality of the caste system and various forms of political structure. Avolo claims are the culmination of spiritual reality forming an authentic form of state structure. He analyzes the regression of the castes and the fallout thereof as the cycles of time ticked down to doomsday, culminating in the Soviet regime and Americanism of contemporary times. He prophesies inevitable destruction of the castes being dragged down to the fourth estate and the supremacy of the worker or proletarian and the ultimate collapse of civilization in the antheap of communist democracy unless the Aryan elites form a cadre globally to revolt against modern world. This work is thus more of a political and historical perspective viewed subspecies identitatis and thus not entirely a work that can serve as a practical guide for action on the part of the average person not in a position of social or economic power. Avolo's more useful and practical works fall within the domain of what would be called spirituality, esotericism or magic. The magical group which he organized and in which he played a significant role called the Ur Group, meaning that which is primordial or original, published a three-volume set of texts entitled Introduction to Magic and featured several prominent Freemasons and magicians whose individual essays serve the reader as a guide to a greater understanding of magical practice oriented toward transcendence and the attainment of the magnum opus, the mechanics of life and death and the structure and function of reality as a multidimensional dynamic system. Avolo wrote under various pseudonyms for this project, and thus it is somewhat uncertain which articles can be attributed to himself. Through some of his pseudonyms were Avo, EA semicolon Agada and Iagla. Avola's study of Tantric Yoga in the originally titled The Man of Power, which was subsequently titled The Yoga of Power, are an exposition of the practice of left-hand path contrast leading to immortality and which is based around Arthur Avalon's The Serpent Power. The work entails a detailed analysis of practices from authenticated primary sources. Later on, Avolo wrote a reputable work on primordial Theravada Buddhism entitled The Doctrine of Awakening, on Buddhist varieties of ascesis. This work illustrates Buddhism in its original form and serves as a basic guide to self-control and transcendence via the void meditation practices of Theravada. Avolo claimed Theravada was an authentically Aryan spirituality which was originally exclusive to the Kshatriya and Brahmanical castes and subsequently became distorted through its democratization, becoming Mahayana Buddhism. H. Emerson was an English soldier who converted to Theravada after reading the Doctrine of Awakening and later stated of it, "I cannot recommend it without reservation," as he presumably discovered that there of it up with not authentically Aryan but arose after the color lines of the castes had already become blurred to miscegenation. He adopted the pseudonym Nyonavira Thiru and eventually died through priapism and some form of dysentery, and one can't help but question whether a devotion to Theravada was not a contributory cause. Buddhism in this form, as far as the writer can understand, is a restriction on the natural sexual impulse and coerces celibacy as part of its rules and regulations. Avolo himself must not have adhered to it owing to his inclination toward tantric maithuna and probably simply practiced Buddhist void meditation techniques and its active nihilism borrowing from it practically. Such an eclecticism would have been sternly critiqued by René Guénon, whose insistence upon adhering to all rules and regulations would have prohibited an authentic practice entailing any practices contradictory to such. However, he might also have contended that once one becomes an adept, rules and regulations cease to apply to him and apply only to the profane uninitiated. This is largely wherein the value of Evola's to tactic and instructional works are concerned, though further intimations of practice can be gleaned from the Hermetic tradition, which treats of medieval alchemy in the Gnostic sense and the meaning and significance of the magnum opus and copious in substantial detail within the medium-sized book. Philosophically, Evola's works are a presentation of the tradition and its representation throughout history and a prescription of an ascetic path leading to power and practice in magic. His earlier works on idealist philosophy purported to critique and supersede it in the form of what he called magical realism as opposed to transcendental idealism, a sort of contemptuous mockery of the philosophical tradition being merely profane and beneath the gnosis of the initiate. Politically, Evola's works also spent a significant range of topics, from critique of the rightist movements of the early 20th century to a critique of the Jewish problem, as well as advice given to the MSI and attempted fascist resurgence led by Pino Rauti, which Evola later reneged as an impossible task in his later works Ride the Tiger and The Path of Cinnabar, and indeed underscores the point that no political activism was possible at this stage in the Kali Yuga that would lead to any meaningful conclusion, and that the chaos of the dark forces simply had to play itself out and end with a whimper, not with a bang. One might critique this and state that this is exactly what these dark forces want for Aryan mankind, to simply lay down and go quietly into the night with a mere whimper. The esoteric Hitlerists would disagree with this stance. For more on which, see the section on esoteric Hitlerism. Radical traditionalism presents a radical stance on personal conduct and prescribes an ascetic path of transcendence in immanence, appropriately encapsulated in the title of Julius Evola's book Ride the Tiger, the only means, according to him, of opposing the influence of modernity in its death throes, the crisis of the modern world. Though radical traditionalism has its flaws and neglects the Hyperborean tradition through excessive focus on the East or Judaized West at times, especially in the case of Ganon, it contains a cornucopia of ideas and practices one might draw upon in their self-development, however corrupted and distorted many of these practices might be. Whether one likes it or not, he must of necessity be a syncretistic and draw upon a variety of sources in order to follow a proper path through the ruins of modernity and remain standing as a red knight amongst the corpses of the Age of the Wolf. Esoteric Hitlerism. The events of the Second World War were a result of the ideas that crystallized around that time. These ideas are what Alfred Rosenberg called the myth of the blood and the reaction to the chaos and violence imposed upon Germany and Europe by the Allied powers under the hegemony of Jewry was made possible through these ideas being made available in the consciousness of the population, motivating them to act in their defense against the external threat of Allied aggression. These racial ideas will be discussed elsewhere, as the focus of this section is on Hitler as a myth, an idea concretized in the flesh, and they who, after his disappearance at the end of the Second World War, again took up the Hitler myth and mediated it through their own particular consciousness and worldview. The Hitler myth was modified as a pleomorphic idea in the minds of different ideologues, philosophers and grassroots political activists, all of whom have embraced the label National Socialism. This label is inextricably bound up with Hitler himself as a historical figure who served as its spokesman and who manifested this idea of Hitlerism through his writings and speeches, which were simply the flip side of the coin of his actions. The actions, decisions and life of Adolf Hitler as a man confirm the truth of the National Socialism idea, and this through its practice corresponding to its idea, no hypocrisy or falsehood being bound up therewith, such as in the case of communism, democracy, Christianity and Freemasonry, the idea of egalitarian universalism which was espoused by the Allied powers. The democratic idea, which is simply a secularized version of the Christian notion that all men are brothers, put itself into practice, revealing the true barbarity and hypocrisy of the intermention and their violent aggression and duplicity, which masquerades as tolerance, love and compassion. The Second World War revealed the moral turpitude of the Intermenschen and they who, regardless of the quality of their biological race, had been infected with this mental virus of the subhuman and its irrational and emotionally based instinctive hatred for that which is higher than itself. The spitefulness and vengeful hatred against they who were the physical embodiments of the Superman can be observed in the fallout of that war and the subsequent occult war waged on all fronts against that same racial stock, just as it has waged without abatement from the beginning of the fall of man. Hitler's idea, that of the superior racial type of Nordico-Germanic, Aryan mankind has been kept alive by several key figures whose pedigree substantiates the legitimate claim to supremacy of this idea and of its attraction to superior people who serve as its embodiment. Throughout the time of Hitler's fight against the forces of chaos, several figures existed in the background who supported the idea and fought for it in word and deed. They spanned the globe and occupied many different countries and even racial groups not of purely Aryan stock. First to be considered is she who some have called Hitler's priestess, Savitri Devi, the assumed name of the Greek woman and mathematician Maximine Portas. She had been actively involved in India in publishing a magazine with her Indian platonic husband Asit Krishna Mukherjee called The New Mercury during the Second World War. During this time she wrote several works favorable to what she called the Hindus, the miscegenated stock of India, in assisting them in opposing the British Empire. She became at one point a legitimate Hindu and was venerated in India by the indigenous. After the Second World War she published works related to her experiences and handed out leaflets in occupied territory for which she was incarcerated in the book Defiance. Her advocacy of the Hitler idea and National Socialism was based perhaps in part or at least found articulation in the statement of a Hindu Swami Satyananda who referred to Hitler as an avatar of Vishnu, the destroyer god, the god of justice whose Nordic equivalent is Thor, the Greco-Roman Jupiter. The Indian may have seeded the idea into Devi's consciousness or may only have given the idea articulation, which latter is more likely to have been the case. Devi wrote Gold in the Furnace, which was a work that illustrated the way in which the National Socialism Weltanschauung becomes stronger like an alloy or mixed metal thrown into a blazing furnace of a certain temperature and pure gold being the outcome, meaning that the more abuse and suffering one undergoes for the idea the stronger it becomes, and only they were capable of facing the truth and possessing it will come out of the furnace of conflict and chaos retaining that mythos. The harsher the conflict and assault, the stronger the person, as truth can't be destroyed, only the person who is too weak and fallible to adhere to it. The avatar Hitler became, Devi spoke of in her work The Lightning and the Sun, which presented a tripartite conception of different types of man as represented in historical figures according to her interpretation. Though her interpretation is not entirely correct, it was a fair presentation of the archetypes of the man in time, the man above time, and the man against time. The meaning of these ideas and how they express and characterize the Hitler myth and National Socialism idea is as follows: being in time means they who have the consciousness of worldliness, they who live within the world of spatio-temporality in time, and who have no transcendent quality, are simply a being who acts within the limited causal conditions of mundane and phenomenal life, purely materialistic and wholly devoid of any spiritual orientation or attachment to the divine. Genghis Khan may have been partially Aryan and adhered to the Mongolian religion of Tengrism, however from historical accounts Devi was acquainted with he was a warlord personified, occupying himself with brute force exclusively and having no higher motive or purpose than worldly conquest and dominance. As such he well illustrates the man in time, which many who have in recent years embraced their own false understanding of National Socialism have mimicked, following the path of Genghis Khan whether they know it or not, without compass or destination, let alone any higher direction in their aggressive journey, attempting to uphold nature's law of tooth and claw and failing to understand what Hitler represented as a man against time. The man above time, Devi characterized as, from her perspective or interpretation, a Brahman, a priest who existed in such a way as to be completely detached from their world and though not having any involvement with it being a pacifist in the figure of a Gandhi or in her work that of Akhenaten, whose religious sun worship she claimed to have been an original Aryan religion which entailed a passive contemplative detachment from the world more or less along the lines of a Christ figure. She misunderstands as perhaps not having had access to adequate historical works on Egypt, that Akhenaten and his Atonist religion were in no way Aryan and that his solar worship was foreign to the consciousness of the Aryan being installed into the consciousness of Egypt by the Hebrew Jewish infiltrators who infiltrated Egypt and attempted to take over. The only thing they managed to permanently install in Egypt, however, was the worship of the solar disk, which led to the destruction of the Aryan caste system of Egypt and, on the false principle that all men are brothers, encouraged mixture, which led to the downfall of Egypt in a logarithmic progression toward destruction, the millennial history of Egypt being brought down into the mire within a few hundred years. The notion of the man above time, however, is valid enough and would correctly apply to Lao Tzu or perhaps the Dalai Lama, as well as the Brahmanical caste of India, both ancient and modern. However, a criticism is that there is not entirely a detachment in the man above time, as he intermediates between the divine and worldly and act in his capacity of priest to elevate and regulate the population in relation thereto, through delegating the administrative activity to the Kshatriya or warrior nobility. The man above time could perhaps become a man against time or merge the two into a unitary form by way of the left-hand path and the mode of detached action of the latter, who may unite in himself both priest and warrior, both Brahman and Kshatriya to varying degrees. Though not explicitly articulated by Devi, her conception of Hitler as a man against time describes this type of figure as a man in the world but not of the world, he who acts within time, within the transience of Maya or phenomenal appearances being unaffected thereby. His modus vivendi is action within the world, and as characterized by Devi is more of a Kshatriya form of life as Hitler embodied in his actions. Hitler adhered to karmic law in his doing what was necessary to minimize harm to his people, of whom he was the leader as the avatar, the embodiment of the folk soul, which served as a vehicle around which his folk polarized in their mutual action of rebuilding Germany after the First World War and leading them against their enemies in a defensive military action in the Second World War. The Hitler avatar was the embodiment of the man against time, Vishnu the destroyer manifesting on the earth to destroy the dark forces and their material embodiment. Devi writes time with a capital T, denoting and connoting the demiurge or the god of jury, the time lord from whom issued all generation corruption in his manifestation, which imposed itself on the higher planes of being and created the material world, or rather who materialized the pre-existent world of first Hyperborea. The conception of the Hitlerist idea propounded by Devi is that of extropy, the opposition to the time flow of entropy of the lord, and resisting this evil tide and its otherwise inevitable extinction of the soul. The Hitlerist conception is thus one of immanent transcendence, of Wei Wu Wei in Chinese Taoist terms. This manifests in the action of Hitler's conscious decision to act, understanding the consequences however harmful, and undergoing the act irregardless, as it has been decided to be the right course, that which accords with karmic law and causes minimal harm to others undeserving of harm. Thus Hitler made decisions which sacrificed many of his own people as well as others, but such sacrifices were necessary to bring about the karmic consequences of the failure to adhere to the idea of hierarchy and authority as embodied in the National Socialism mythos and the myth of the blood. Savitri Devi was herself consistent in her worldview, practicing what she preached throughout her life in her involvement with Hitlerist movements in England and Europe, though she fell into a misanthropic version of environmentalism and a form of Vaishnavism which she misunderstood to be a form of Vedism. She was nonetheless relatively consistent in her views with the primordial conception of Vedic India, one of the original Aryan empires after the fall of the Gobi Desert civilization. Her hostility toward mankind and her overly materialistic conception unduly supported a thonic Earth Mother worldview, which must be considered somewhat foreign to the original National Socialism and its more balanced and folkish approach. Contemporaneous with the work of Savitri Devi was that of James Larrow Battersby, who penned the work The Holy Book of Adolf Hitler. This work of Battersby's was an attempt on his part to associate National Socialism with Christianity, claiming that Hitler was a Christ archetype. The work is prophetic in its tone and was written just after the Second World War in England, from whence Battersby hailed. The sign of a haberdasher, Battersby served the role of a prophet of sorts in his work, prognosticating that the return of Christ would be inevitable, and with his return the destruction of the Anglo-American powers, with both Russian and German forces uniting to overthrow the Zionist evil empire. He quoted from many National Socialism during the Nuremberg trials in their oracular statements forewarning what was to come for the allies of evil, the servants of the demiurge, and his work convincingly persuades the open-minded reader of the likelihood of these events transpiring. Battersby, shortly after writing this work, was interred in a concentration camp and subjected to torture, which he documented in his work The Bishop Said Amen, on the author's experiences during detention as a pacifist. He was shortly after his release run out of his parents' business, which he voluntarily left to prevent its economic sabotage through the smear campaigns of Jewry. He was to suffer a tragic accident, having his neck snapped in the paddle wheel of a boat, possibly having been assassinated by Jewry owing to his revelation of the method in the Holy Book of Adolf Hitler. Should Battersby's conception of Christ be some form of esoteric or non-biblical understanding paralleling the work of Pertschew in the latter's work The Mystery of the Central Sun, it may be the case that this is true, with the second coming of Christ being an increase of the emanations of the galactic center as the solar system moves closer toward it, elevating the vibrational frequency of the Earth and melting the ice rings around the planet Saturn, which have transformed this Earth into a soul farm for the dark forces. Battersby died young, not having had much chance to actively participate in the National Socialism resurgence, but sowing the seed idea and keeping the concept of Hitlerism alive in the Zionist occupation of England after the Second World War, giving the people of England a blueprint for their own salvation, the Hitler idea and its political manifestation, National Socialism. During the 60s and into the 90s, the National Socialism Colin Jordan, also of England, came on the scene. His work National Socialism, Vanguard of the Future, is a compendium of his philosophy which critiques the degradation of contemporary English society and its degenerate youth who have unwittingly followed the lead of Jewry in attempting to transform the purity and nobility of National Socialism into a skinhead movement centered not around love of the folk but around hatred for the other and a deviant immersion and what the National Socialists properly called Entata to Kunst. Jordan held a master's degree in mathematics from Cambridge University and was a tutor of youth, becoming a major spokesman for the National Socialism movement in England after the Second World War, after Arnold Lees, the head of the National Socialism Party, died. Jordan spoke of the inevitability of the demise of the Anglo-American Empire and in the same terms as Savitri Devi of the forces against time. The idea of Hitler being an avatar was not made explicit in Jordan's works but was nonetheless propounded in an unexpressed or implicit way, as well as the distraction between the dark forces as embodied in Jewry and they of the light as embodied in the leftward swastika against the cycles of time, which Jordan explicitly referenced in his work. Though Jordan speaks of nature, this term is not meant in the sense of a purely earthly and mundane understanding but simply in the sense of the nature of things, or that which is ontologically real and corporative of higher dimensions and forms of life, not purely confined to the mundane worldview of the profane. Though Jordan's writings were written to target a more general audience, they hinted at that which lay beyond this world, though in the hermetic sense of spirituality, not in that of a Judeo-Christian pseudo-spirituality of Hebrew invention. Across the ocean in America during this same time, George Lincoln Rockwell was leading his American Nazi Party into the public consciousness in theatrical fashion. Having grown up in a vaudeville family, having been immersed in theater and having been acquainted with Jews from a young age, Rockwell followed his left-hand path of rebellion against the cycles of time throughout his career, which ended in his untimely assassination. Rockwell made the dynamic of the forces of light versus the forces of darkness clear and obvious to the average American with his rabble-rousing speeches and television interviews, his cartoonish stunts and his clear and distinct logical presentation of the Jewish problem in his works White Power and This Time the World. Rockwell is not very explicit in his conveyance of any esoteric dimension in his articulation of this world historical problem, though his life gives one insight into the fact of not only his legitimacy as an authentic embodiment of the Hitler idea but as a figure who had communion with beings from higher dimensions who worked with and influenced him. Rockwell himself related an experience of this kind in his autobiography. That Rockwell had obtained a philosophy degree from a prestigious Ivy League school, one of the best in America, should suggest to most that he was in no way a purely materialistic thinker. He married an Icelandic woman, and the significance of this in spiritual terms is not only the purity of the blood, the blue-eyed, blonde-haired Icelanders being the closest to the Vanir, but the proximity of Iceland to the hollow earth and the radiations emanating therefrom having a transmutative influence on the consciousness of its denizens. that Rockwell gravitated toward his Icelandic wife and was accepted by her means that he was no average everyday person but someone more spiritually inclined. Perhaps having been contemporaries Savitri Devi, Colin Jordan and Miguel Serrano, it suggests that he may have been an embodiment of the Avatar as well as Hitler before him and his contemporaries along with him. James Madoll appeared on the scene in New York around the time of Rockwell and was a sort of rival of the commander with his National Renaissance Party. Madoll is little known, but his work was nonetheless a valuable contribution to esoteric Hitlerism and the myth of the blood. He was an adherent of Blavatsky's original theosophy and wrote concerning the antediluvian world of Atlantis. He was also notorious for propounding the final solution to the Jewish problem, that being extermination, which he advocated. Just after Rockwell's assassination, another proponent of the Hitlerist idea came on the scene who, though as a fallible man critical of Hitlerism in some respects, was a supporter of Hitler and the folkish idea. In the case of Ben Klassen, however, the idea was amplified to be more inclusive of the entire white race and condemned nationalism as a divisive element in National Socialism. Ben Klassen preferred the term racial socialism and manifested it in his works of what he would go on to call creativity, the white man's religion. His major works encapsulated his conception of a naturalistic worldview. He departed from this worldview, however, in many of the phrases he used as well as the hermetic colors he used in his works, all of which were published with a red, white and black color scheme similar to the National Socialists. This color scheme connoted the Negredo or blackening phase, the albedo phase and the rubedo phase of integration, the hermetic alchemical transmutation process of the magnum opus or the great work. Nature's Eternal Religion was his first work and is followed up with The White Man's Bible, which was a more didactic and less philosophical presentation of the racial socialist creed of Klassen's creativity movement. Later he would go on to author another work, his autobiography entitled Against the Evil Tide, perhaps referring not only to the material forces on this earth arrayed against the white race but against the time flow of the demiurge and entities who are his devotees and who the writer contends are the creators of Jewry via genetic engineering. Klassen made no reference to any higher forces than a tangible, palpable realities of the world and organic life visible and observable to the average person. This is probably deliberate, as his intention was to throw out a wider net to capture the minds of more average and less intellectual people with his basic creed and program. That it is formulated in religious terms serves his purpose in appealing to a wider audience who have need of a well-articulated value system that appeals to their level of consciousness and that does not leave the adherent used, confused and abused with the priestly caste claptrap of Judeo-Christianity and its delusional inventions, which serve to drive the flock into states of fear-based consciousness and lead them to live pacifistic life of cowardly obsequiousness before the Jews to whom they sell their souls. After Rockwell passed on, Matt Cole took over the American Nazi Party organization and stayed largely in the background, keeping the black flame of Promethean fire alive, writing sparsely and being most recognized for his handbook compilation of Mein Kampf quotations entitled The Words of Hitler, as well as his ideological tract Faith of the Future, which was a work of naturalism to all appearances. That Cole was in contact with Savitri Devi may suggest he was more than a proponent of a crude naturalistic worldview, though his writings reveal no higher perspective than such, and thus he could be interpreted to be a lesser flame of the Luciferian light at best, as far as they who were not intimately acquainted with him and his activity can glean. The foremost representative of esoteric Hitlerism is the adept and nobleman who created the term esoteric Hitlerism itself, Don Miguel Serrano, a Chilean diplomat, active National Socialism and esotericism. His works encapsulate the Hitler idea as well as the doctrine of racial socialism, of whom the German National Socialists were simply a particular instance, and indeed laid out the template for the Weltanschauung, which, though allegedly not for export, was and is perfectly adaptable to any society founded on blood and soil. Serrano amplified the idea as a seed develops into a plant. His work is the fruitage of the seed idea of the Hitlerist worldview. In his work Adolf Hitler, The Last Avatar, Serrano provides copious detail from his own experiences and connections that Hitler did not die after the Second World War, and that the National Socialists of Germany departed for Antarctica after the Second World War. He relates his experiences in discussions with key National Socialism figures such as Hermann Wirth and Hannah Reich and his influence in political affairs, all of which lend credibility to his more esoteric claim that the average mundane could not nor would have any inclination to understand, confining themselves as they do to a purely materialistic worldview. Serrano's conception of Adolf Hitler as an avatar of Vishnu is carried forward from Savitri Devi and Swami Satyananda, from whom she derived the conception, and is amplified in the influence of Hitler, the consequences and origins of Hitler's presence on the earth. According to Serrano, Hitler became possessed by the archetype just after he had attended a play by Richard Wagner and, being accompanied by his friend August Kubitschek, had an epiphany, breaking from his friend in ascending a hill upon which the avatar took possession of him. Hitler was an avatar, a physical man possessed by a higher being who selected him to carry out the work needed to oppose the Allied aggression against Germany and indeed to put a stop to the usury system run by Jewry internationally from their financial centers of New York and London. Simultaneously, the archetype took possession of individual leaders in diverse nations who played a similar role as Hitler in awakening their populations to overthrow the parasitical exploiter of their race. Chandra Bose in India, Phibun in Thailand, Hirohito in Japan, Mussolini in Italy, who was perhaps simply the preliminary thunder before the lightning of the man against time, Hitler, Corneliu Condreanu in Romania, Juan Antonio Primo de Rivera and Francisco Franco in Spain, Plinio Salgado in Brazil, Laureano Eleuterio Gomez Castro in Colombia, Arnold Margery in Venezuela, William Pelley, Henry Ford and Charles Lindbergh in America, Arnold Leese and Oswald Mosley in England, Leon de Grel in Belgium, and General Andrei Vlosov in Russia, Ferenc Soloshi in Hungary and many others globally arose to the call of Vishnu, the destroyer god, and manifested on the earth to put a stop to the intrigue and disintegrative tactics of the international Jew who concealed himself either in the mantle of capitalism or communism Marxism and attempted a coup in all countries simultaneously under the guise of the Brotherhood of Man and the Federation of the World. The mundane cynic would interpret the simultaneous events which transpired in each country during this epoch prior to the Second World War either as copycat imitators of Hitler or as a cleverly contrived global scheme to create a reactionary movement against the Jewish internationalists, against their invented bogeymen of communism and capitalism, and to orchestrate chaos as means of consolidating Jewish power post-World War II. The more spiritually minded individual, however, would look upon Serrano's conception of the avatar as more credible owing to its scope and the magnitude of its consequences. That Hitler was indeed a man possessed by the archetype of Vishnu is suggested by his apparently incomprehensible decision-making, such as his decision to strike against Russia as the greater threat, even though to all appearances it was pragmatically useful to form an alliance with them against the Anglo-American powers. To do so would have meant a compromise of the idea of National Socialism, transforming it into a mere anti-capitalist stance, dragging down the higher idea of hierarchy which depended upon spiritual authority to an idea of materialistic leveling equality with no higher reference point to serve the higher type of Aryan mankind, and thus to submerge the world in darkness. Even though the average person would state that a temporary compromise would not have jeopardized the idea of National Socialism and would not have enabled its continuance, that these ideas derived from higher forces means such a compromise would have rendered them impotent and thus have neutralized them, if only after whatever pyrrhic and unlasting victory could be attained. That the idea of a quasi-Brahmanical hierarchy concentrated in a leader is an eternal verity implies that the victory of Hitler even in defeat was inevitable. Indeed, as Serrano speaks of in his works, Hitler won in the spiritual through losing in the physical, as it was not on the basis of truth, the idea of Hitlerism as opposed to that of democracy and communism, that the Allies had achieved their pyrrhic victory but only on that of brute force, of the weight of numbers and not on the basis of any higher principle, reveals that Hitler did not lose the war. Hitler, as Serrano had said, won by losing, preserving the purity of his idea against all treachery and deceit on the part of the allies of evil. Serrano's works entail a revelation of the coming war against the evil horde of Jewry and their minions, and the return of the original National Socialists who departed from this degraded world into Antarctica. In his work Hitler's UFOs Against the New World Order, Serrano reveals the details of the National Socialist creation of UFOs and how they had used them at the end of the Second World War and departed with them to another dimension via wormholes as well as into the hollow earth through Antarctica. Hitler was a member of the Thule Gesellschaft and its mediums were in contact with Aldebaran, the Aryan homeland in the constellation Taurus and from whom they derive much of their most advanced technology. This technology was articulated in Serrano's book and discussed Victor Schauberger, its developer, who utilized cold fusion and implosive power which Nikola Tesla had previously developed. This technology enabled the National Socialists to depart from this world and return to Aldebaran. However, not all did, and the fiasco relating to flying saucers appearing post-World War II was undoubtedly these craft of the National Socialists who made displays of their power after the Second World War, preventing a further increase in hostilities of violence perpetrated by the usual suspects, the allies of evil servants of the Demiurge Jehovah. Serrano's Weltanschauung is a comprehensive cosmology and anthropology, or rather anthropogenesis, which is similar to Blavatsky's theosophy, only more correctly adjusted and attuned to the original secret doctrine of the Atlantean and indeed the Hyperborean tradition. Serrano posits that the Nordico-Germanic race are the descendants of what in the Bhagavad Gita are called Devas and Vanir in the Nordic Edda. These are the original race on Earth of humanity, properly so called. All they who preceded them were the Neanderthal beastmen and various mixtures who occupied Lemuria, which was also known as Mu or Pan during this time. The subsequent mixture with the anthropoids constituted the fall of man, causing the Asiagodi to lose their first estate and become who they are today. Serrano's booklet We Will Not Celebrate the Death of the White Gods provides a briefer synopsis of this anthropogenesis than his more extensive works such as Manu, For the Man to Come and Adolf Hitler, The Last Avatar. Serrano's initial work in his Esoteric Hitlerist Quaternary, The Golden Cord, Esoteric Hitlerism, reveals the lineage of the Hitler idea preceding Hitler, which he equates with the Luciferian conception or conception of the left-hand path of imminent transcendence, or the man against time, he who fights the demiurge both individually as an organism and politically as part of a larger organism, his folk, against the forces of this earth who wish to enslave its population and steal their souls. Serrano speaks of this golden cord, which refers to the Citrinitas phase of Hermetic alchemy, to philosophical golden, which he puts forth as originally an Aryan conception having its origins in the ancient Aryan homelands of Atlantis and subsequently the Gobi Desert and other regions of the earth up to the present day. The persecution of the Aryan adepts by such as the Catholic Church and its control as jewelry throughout the millennia are revealed, and the intimate ties between the Luciferian tradition and National Socialism are also detailed in extensive discussion of Otto Rahn, the SS leader, and his work Lucifer's Court and experiences based thereon. The golden cord continues to this day in the form of adepts such as Serrano, who continue to fight against the dark forces and their master Jehovah the Demiurge. Serrano puts forth various recommendations and instructions that the worthy reader might adopt and follow in all of his works, from the Armanist path of rune workings to tantric Methuna. His works Resurrection of the Hero and Adolf Hitler, The Last Avatar, are especially revelatory in their detailed presentation of left-hand path practices to achieve the magnum opus, the full integration of the soul, i.e. immortality, becoming a living god. These are the authentic Aryan practices, not the vile black magic of the Near East as embodied in Masonry and Jewish Kabbalah and its variants, which Serrano critiques throughout his works. They are rather the magical practices of the Armanists, the ancient Aryan adepts who embody the principles of truth and justice and who still exist both on this earth and on other worlds and in other dimensions. Esoteric Hitlerism, though undergoing different forms of manifestation, is this golden cord of the original Hyperborean tradition extending to the present time against time, against the Demiurge and his legions of beastmen and vampiric creatures who require the vital essence of others in order to perpetuate their entropic existence. It is necessary and imperative at this time that all who merit the term Aryan to devote themselves to perpetuating the golden cord of esoteric Hitlerism and to combat, to the greatest extent possible, the dark forces and liberate the earth of their pestilential presence. Call to a mask of power, hockey's spiritual virility only creators are hard Nietzsche and the puck is dropped. Dick Irving note, the past tense is used as it refers to a moment frozen in time, as the ice of a hockey rink is frozen or a vintage photograph of the good old hockey game. Hockey typifies the Canadian tradition. It is the Canadian tradition in miniature and spans the history of Canada during a time when the nation was being built by the creativity of the Aryan race. In its traditional form, hockey was a game of will and skill where the players were pitted against one another in a microcosm of the macrocosm of eternal struggle and for victory over the opponent. However, this game was a game of rules, of order, that microcosmically embodied the laws of the cosmos as above so below, so the struggle which was played out on the earth plane, on the ice, was not a free-for-all of ruthless savagery. As such, it was decidedly Aryan in its nature, was rule-based and was a channeling of the will to power consciously directed towards a goal. The goal was to score a team victory by the simple and yet paradoxically complex deposition of a rubber disc into a net, a representation perhaps of a Vimana from above directed through Aryan will into the skull's net of the matrix reality of the material planet deposited there deliberately and with the intention of stooping to conquer, to spiritualize the material world against the demiurge. The rules were the parameters in which the conscious entity, the Aryan, had to play with in order to play at all, the violation of which consigning him to the penalty box or to forfeit the game entirely. The rink was the arena or theater of the real in which the Aryan played at war and which battle was confined within its bounds circumscribed by the rules of the game. It was a game in which two opposing teams vied with one another for dominance and sought to succeed in scoring the most goals, meaning that the players would move the puck with their sticks and attempt to move it into the net past the player whose task was to prevent it, again, within his own circumscribed sphere called a crease. One might liken the puck to the soul, initially black or unenlightened, being moved throughout the rink and undergoing various experiences until finally retiring when the game ends, being used by all the players and being carried from one into the other.